morning to most, good afternoon to others, and good evening to those across the pond. I am Jason Miles, your host for another episode of this Revolution Podcast. As you can, oh, you can't see actually where I am. My camera's off. But I am not at home. I got an opportunity to come see my son last minute, so I am in downtown, wonderful downtown Los Angeles. If you're new to the channel, please like, subscribe. If you're enjoying what you see, make sure you hit the notifications bell as we are constantly adding new episodes, new shows to the channel. Just yesterday, I launched one of many new programs that will be coming to the channel in the coming months, Pop Life. It's a more fun pop culture conversations around music and film. And will be co-hosted with my good friend and musician, who some of you may remember from his appearance on our Woodstock 99 episode. The first episode is up now, so you can hear my talk with singer of influential metal hardcore band 18 Visions, James Hart. And if you dig the music and more fun talk with little bits of seriousness, I think y'all will really dig this new show. Also, for those that watch the show, I don't know if you guys know this, but we're also an audio podcast as well. Actually, this show started out as an audio-only show because I didn't want to plaster this ugly mug all over the net. But alas, things change. Our show is available on audio as well. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever else you get your podcasts. You can find all of our episodes starting from the first one 3 years ago. Actually, next month it'll be 3 years. And when Pascal came on the show, the audio shows are actually totally different from the streams. So if you go back into the archives, you'll even hear shows that you didn't even know we did, like my interview with Mike Davis and just a whole lot more. So make sure you check out the audio stuff as well. Also, I want to talk about, we have new merchandise. We have the new TIR Central Committee shirt. You can get a shirt with Pascal smiling on it. Do you know how rare that is? A shirt with a smiling Pascal? Let me pull it up so you can see. So you can see what I'm talking about. Oh, there it is. Hold on. Bam! There it is. The Central Committee. The cogs that make the machine of this show work. All of us right there. And it's also in mug form. And mouse pad form. So if you haven't checked that out, you can please check it out. Also, we're setting up the website where we're streaming the show on the website as well. We want it to be the one-stop shop for everything that is TIR. All that being said, I can't forget the biggest news of all, and I might even, if I have some time, go by the venue. We're doing a live show in LA next month, October 23rd. Give them a revolution. This is a revolution. Give them an argument. Left Reckoning. Daniel Bessner, Derek Varn, so many more. So there should be a link in the description for the show, whether you're seeing it or hearing it later, for tickets. And there's still some VIP tickets left. All that out of the way. There's no Pascal today because this topic is a little too serious for him. He doesn't take this seriously enough. Toussaint wasn't here because she doesn't take this seriously enough. But there is a man, another part of the Central Committee, the behind-the-scenes producer, and does so much. Part of the artistic direction of the show. Please welcome Mean Gene Bajlan.
Well, you don't have the soundboard today, but you do an excellent soundboard. Firstly, I have some commentary to make. Number one, we all know the real reason you didn't want to show your face for so long was not because it was ugly, but because you know what happens when women see the Jason Miles and men. When women and men see Jason Miles, they're like, they won't leave him alone. They can't get enough of that Jason Miles love, you know? So You had to hide your beauty, you know, your statuesque African physique, you know?
Wow, now it's an African physique. My last name is French.
French, oh yeah. Maybe you're Haitian, you know? Maybe you're of Haitian origin. Well, yes, today we have a serious topic because, you know, Pascal got the day off because, you know, when you try and talk science fiction with Pascal, it's like, he's like, I remember watching him on something. I can't remember what I was watching him on, but they started talking. Was it
Brianna Joy? Yeah.
Yeah, he was on Brianna Joy Gray, and they were talking about science fiction. And Pascal was like, yeah, I like lasers and pew, pew, pew. Yeah, I like that. And it's like, Pascal, you've never seen Star Wars. And today, you know, today we're going to be tackling a very controversial topic. I think, you know, we'll be entering the Catrone Zone, you know. And it will be probably Chris Catrone's most controversial take. I stand by his defense of the prequels.
I feel like this is how controversial it is. Chris Catrone right now could slap a baby in the middle of downtown Chicago and wouldn't get the comments that he would get for saying that the Star Wars prequels have merit. Not even like they're great. Just say that there's merit to the
merit
people.
Merit to them, yeah.
Yeah, just people just like, oh my God, you're shitting all over my life.
How could you, like, people really, I mean, there's a lot of problems with them, but I think they are meritorious and virtuous in a certain way.
I read Michael Harris's book when it came out, Welcome to the Rebellion on Zero. And I really liked it, and it made me go watch the prequels again. And then I rewatched the prequels with the little one, who's actually here, Phoenix. You know, and he's a baby, and you know, watching stuff with Zal has... He digs it because it's colorful, right? But he watched all the prequels, and rewatching them and knowing the context, it hit a little different. I can't just go rewatch them like I can rewatch like Empire Strikes Back at any moment in time, because Empire Strikes Back is a moment of my childhood that means so much to me. And I think with these movies, and we're going to get more into this when we bring in Catrone, but there's so much about these movies that define people's childhoods that when George Lucas did two things, and definitely going to get Chris's opinion on this at some point. When he re-released the original three with edited footage, the added scenes, and then the prequels followed that, it was almost like he was just slapping the fans with his penis.
Nah. But it made sense that he was doing something that he wanted to do that he couldn't because of the technological limitations. Of the time, so it's kind of understandable. You know, there is actually one thing I want to remind people now that everybody's filtering in, guys. If you can, instead of dropping a super chat today, please consider supporting our Get Jason a New Computer fundraiser. Jason does not like to talk about this fundraiser, but we decided, Jason, it is time to move on from Obama's first term and get a new computer, because Jason's computers, he is a magic man, right? He is a magical man who has managed to keep a computer from Obama's first term working.
Two computers working.
So we're getting together, and we're trying to raise $2,500 to get him his new computer. We're at $910 so far. So it would be really helpful if people, I'm putting the link in the chat. So people really, instead of a super chat, which goddamn YouTube has always taken their cut from us. So, you know, you can help
and
us
they've
out.
And they've been real difficult, too, about having the videos be monetizable. So even though our views are going up.
Monetizable.
Yeah, they're not being monetized. But.
And today we're going to get demonetized because we're dealing with the most controversial topic in history, which is Star Wars.
You know what's funny? Gene Bajlan, for those of you guys that don't know, does a show with Derek Barnes called Gaming Materials where they talk about tabletop gaming. They're not saying any bad words. I don't even think they curse on the show.
No cursing.
And every episode of Gene's show is limited ads, or they don't run ads at all, so we have to, like, fight. all the appeals came through for every show, except for Pascal's last mile hour as well. Also, they said, we've seen it and you can't have it being monetized.
Wow.
It's so incendiary. Speaking about the 70s, I found that going, really? That's weird. But speaking of magical people, I don't believe in magical Negroes, but I came across a video on Twitter and I think this man may be magical. Even though Pascal is not here and Marcus is not here and Toussaint is not here, this would be the perfect trigger warning video for them. I don't know if Gene necessarily will get triggered by it because he's just a racist.
Are you saying I expect this type of behavior from black yes. people? So is that what you're saying to me?
Yes.
Wow. You're accusing
Like if you would have saw it, you'd be like, hmm.
Well, I have to say, since I started hanging out with you and Pascal, I've definitely become more racist. That is like 100%. You've turned me into, like, before I'd be like, let's try and understand, let's be sensitive to the plight of the African American. And now, you know, Pascal's like, what are you talking about, Gene? Shut up. They're just trying to make money off you.
So I just need to play this real quick. It's a very short video, but in it, there's life lessons. I don't want to say like, these aren't racial life lessons. I think these are definitely, I think Gene will agree. These are hood life lessons. I'm sure there's an area where you're from, Gene and Hull, where if the same thing happened, you would not have done what these people did.
Yeah, it's called Brantome. It's called Brantome. It's the largest housing estate in Europe. It also, in the 90s, had the highest teenage pregnancy rate in Europe, none of which was to do with me. So lucky Jason was there, because we probably would have got an increase in the factor by 10, you know?
You are so mean. So here, I'm going to play this for you guys real quick. I find this mildly amusing, so hopefully you guys will as well. Okay, right there, when you're punching that guy, and you think you're punching him with all your might, and he's standing there eating those punches like that, either you hit him with a chair like pro wrestling,
or you go home.
You go home. Because the game's about to be over right here. So keep watching. And that last punch, you ever have those dreams where you think like you can't punch hard enough in the dream and you wake up all mad because you couldn't defeat whatever? But that's how that guy.
What the hell kind of dreams are you having, Jason?
Very frightening ones.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can hear, they're bragging about saying they kicked his ass.
So yeah, well.
So watch what happens next.
Nah, I ain't gonna fight. He looked like he about to get ass. I said it.
Okay, Jason, you identify with this guy, A, because he's an older gentleman, and B, because he's wearing hot pants like you do. Like, you're like, yeah, this is me. This is
that
me.
That is so me in the summer. That is hella, but he's got more hair than me. That is definitely me in the summer in Mexico. I definitely have, but my shorts like that are actually more Daisy Duke-esque. So you can almost see the ball bag. This dude looks like he might be a legit bike messenger. Now,
he looks hench.
Here's a lesson for everyone. If you've just tried to get into a late night drunken fight with a gentleman and he's not fazed by your punches, and then he says, hold on, and goes into his bag, don't stay to see what comes out of the bag. You will never, ever, ever win.
Bro, please go.
Hatchet. Oh. There's a hatchet. Oh. Broke your phone. Hatchet.
Nah.
All the tough guy just oozed right out of them in a series of bowel movements.
Oh.
Oh. Oh. Oh. Look at right. Look right there. Uh-huh. I thought she was hard. This is how I want to treat internet trolls.
Yeah, this is why Jason isn't allowed in the comments anymore, because he keeps inviting himself over to people's houses for them so they can say the things they say online to him in his face.
This is literally how I would show up at your house with a hatchet. Like, say it again. So remember how tough those guys were when they were fighting. These are all the same guys that were punching him in the head and then talking crap.
Watch this.
Look.
Oh. I got the grip.
He just slapped him.
He didn't even close his fist.
He just slapped him like a child. Wait, watch this. Then
that's why I keep my life on me all the time, man. Shit like this, you never know.
Look, now he's gonna walk over to one of the girlfriends and give her a life lesson on why hanging out with these guys is not a good idea. I think that girl was just sitting in her own urine at that point, because I would have been had that man that man came up to me with a hatchet giving life advice on why my friends So you don't see it, he actually shook her hand. He shakes her hand. Now, Gene, see this woman right here?
Yeah.
This is what you want in your life. This is beyond a ride or die. She is standing in front of the hatchet man to say,
ready to take an axe.
He's ready to take an axe for this dude. Now he's acting like he's gonna do something, but right now what he's trying to do is hold his bowels together. That's what he's trying to do, because he's terrified, because he sees a very large man about to hatchet up all of his friends
and their mobile phones.
He just destroyed everyone's mobile phone. And then the girl jumped in front of him. This woman deserved. Look, I want to go up to this kid right now. Like, had I been there, I would have went to that kid and be like, look, dude, it's never going to get any better than this. This woman right here needs a ring right now, because you will never find a woman willing to step in front of an axe wielding madman that has just made all of your friends urinate on themselves at the McDonald's in New York City. Sarah Bajlan is not doing this for Gene.
No, she would probably say, I deserve getting the hatchet.
She might scream from a distance.
She's like, come on, finish him off so I get the insurance.
Yeah. Okay, it's almost over. Yes, but this woman deserves. She's my hero. And then, I'm out.
He's up.
Yeah, I'm out. All right. I'll talk to you guys later.
I think we should get Chris in to see what he thinks about
this. Yeah, I want to see FC, because you know Chris lives in the Chi, so I'm sure he's been to a McDonald's or two in his life. Please welcome Chris Catrone.
Hello.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Have you ever seen an incident like that in Chicago?
Rarely.
Really?
Although I feel like now I'm ready to see it anytime, because I do think conditions have changed. I think it's gotten worse.
Oh, I actually, yeah. Chicago?
Well, just in general, I think that people are on their like last bit of patience or something. They're just
I agree with that.
I mean, carrying a hatchet in your bike messenger bag.
Well, that actually happened to me. That happened to me this week, this past week. I was walking in downtown Rosarito, and I was going to you have to do everything in cash in Mexico, as you can imagine, right? Pay your bills. Everything's in cash.
Mm-hmm.
All this online shit you Americans do.
Yeah.
So I'm walking to the ATM, and as I'm walking, this dude thinks I'm walking at him.
Oh.
And it's late at night. It's probably like 10, 11 o'clock at night. Uh-huh. And he's got a bag like that. And he goes, I got a knife. I just yelled out, I don't want to see the bag. I don't want to see the bag. And he was all messed up. He told me he got beat up. And so.
Oh, so he was.
I was running across the street to get to the
ATM. And he just thought that you were coming at him.
He was gonna do me the hatchet man job.
That's racial profiling, right? There running black man equals that's
look, he got lumped up. Somebody lumped him up because he was lumped up, and he was like, he goes, look man, somebody lumped me up. And I was like, I get it.
Can I just ask you up. Yes. Can I ask this question? I don't know that there's like anti-black racism in Mexico the way there is in the United States, because there aren't
not even close no Not there even the Haitians get it, no.
Right? So it's not like you see a black person and it's like crime.
If Doug Lane had sauntered towards him.
Yeah, he would have the same. He would have said exactly, the same right?
Yeah. But I think Chris raises an important point.
He's a scruffy white guy, dangerous. Yeah.
After all this COVID, after all this lockdown, with all this economic stress. Like, obviously, there's people who, like, have lost their jobs, who are homeless. The homeless situation, as you were talking about on TYT the other day, is out of control. But, like, for regular, people who are employed and have even, like, middle-class lives, this is so much more stress and tension in your life. Like, I know from my personal case, like, I have a nice job. I have a comfortable job. But because, everything was disrupted, like, I've got two small kids. I'm awake all the time. I had to like look after them while I'm working and things like that. People are on the edge. And I haven't seen Hatchet Man in the McDonald's, but I've seen people lose it, absolutely lose their temper.
Wait, check it out. Jason, did you just like the way he pronounced McDonald's?
Yeah.
McDonald's?
That was priceless.
I
don't know if that's, but that was very British. Like
McDonald's.
Gene is British as fuck.
McDonald's.
We have one rule. Chris, we have one rule on TIR, and that is never hide your accent. Wherever you're from, you double down on that accent.
I like McDonald's because
McDonald's.
Like, but, ready for Scottish like national independence. Like
right. Exactly. Ready for a Highland rebellion. I'll tell you, we used to in Britain, I mean, when people click like, I don't know if this exists. Maybe, Chris, it exists in Chicago still. But, in America, I've noticed everything is strip malls, out of town, kind of separated and driving orientated, at least
in the suburbs of Chicago, for sure. Not so much New York. New York, where I grew up, the suburbs are more urban.
But in Britain, still, even in like a small town like Hull, where I'm from, the nightlife and everything is still orientated in the city center. There is an increase of the out of town stuff, but like if you're going out on a Friday night or a Saturday night, you're going to town, you're going to the city center. And the big thing to do after going out on a night on the razzle is to go for a kebab at a kebab shop.
Yeah.
And I remember like people would go nuts at this kebab shop. There was a kebab shop called Rose Pizza. And I remember these like drunk English lads came in. And they like ordered their pizza, right? And then they got their pizza. They said it wasn't the pizza they wanted. They threw it at these Kurdish guys who ran the kebab shop. I was in the back of the kebab shop. And then they threw me the keys. They said, lock the door, Gene. And so I locked the door. And let's just say things happened with a pizza shovel, which I will never forget in my mind's eye about what happened to those kids with the pizza shovel. Because if you're selling food to drunk people late at night, You know, you need to have some.
You gotta be prepared.
You've got to be prepared because, like, we used to do it at the Chinese takeaway I used to work at, and I had to like duck from burning molten curry sauce being thrown at me at the thing. So, but yeah, people are on edge. I mean, what I'm saying is like people are on edge. Like, you're right, Chris. Like, I think everybody is stressed. Whether you've got a job, whether you're financially secure, whether you're not, it's just so much bullshit has happened.
I mean, I'm just like ready, you know, I'm like total Scarface. I'm like, don't fuck with me, man.
Don't fuck with me, man.
It's
there you go. Scarface Catron.
This is actually kind of leading into something I want to talk about before we actually discuss Star Wars.
You know, CEO, check it out, CEO of McDonald's. McDonald's has its headquarters here, I think, outside Chicago.
Makes sense.
And CEO of McDonald's just issued a statement saying that their commitment to the city is not ironclad if conditions become too unsafe. So even though that incident was in New York, right, they're saying the McDonald's locations have become so unsafe that they might have to pull out of the city.
It's also it's interesting that they say that because it becomes part of their business model as well. I think, I don't know if you ever watch me say this on the show, but, and I don't know if you were on the show where I talked about this, Gene, when I crossed the border, I crossed so early to try to avoid the traffic that there's the city right after is called San Isidro, and there's a McDonald's there that's open 24 hours. Now the lobby's open 24 hours, and people literally live in the parking lot kind of around the corner in their cars. And there's a massive, not massive, but yeah, there's a kind of big complex of weekly hotels, which, you know, in most major metropolitan areas, are just flop houses. And they kind of serve a weird dual purpose because you also have citizenship stuff where people sometimes are waiting for people. So
they have to pop into McDonald's because they're waiting so long.
That's where the bathroom is.
Oh, bathroom. Uh-huh.
That's where the bathroom is. So I still feel bad. I can't just like go in there and just use the bathroom and just like hang out in my car for a little bit before I go drive wherever I got to go. So I actually will buy something. And most McDonald's you'll see, unless it starts to get way out of control, like San Francisco, like downtown San Francisco just got way out of control, they don't mind because it's a constant flow of business because most people understand, even the unhoused, I have to at least buy something if I'm going to be in here using your Wi-Fi. Because it's also the only place outside of the, better than the library. The bathroom's cleaner than the library. The Wi-Fi is better than the library.
No doubt.
That dollar coffee's refillable. So it's interesting to see how they will just drain
the
dollar they can.
The fries at McDonald's are the best. I mean, that's why the bike passenger is just like, I'm going to McDonald's and I don't care. I'm getting my fries and I'm bringing a hatchet. And I'm still getting my fries.
Look, his hatchet carrying was totally vindicated. It was like, of course he was defending himself, you know, like, of course he needed the hatchet, right? Because those guys, like, they were like, imagine that guy was not like Jason Miles's long lost twin, right? And he was just it's the clothing. It's the clothing, Chris. Like, that guy was literally wearing what Jason wears.
He got it flaunted.
Yeah, exactly. But if it was just some kid, because these bullies out there, they're always doing this kind of stuff. They're always picking on people. I remember my friend, he, like, got robbed at, I think it was a McDonald's. It was something like a McDonald's. You know, they just come in, and they just, like, talk a lot of shit. They intimidate people, and then, you know, take their stuff and they don't do anything about it. But they obviously picked on the wrong guy this time. They picked on the guy who's been like clearly lifting weights and cycles and cycles like 30 miles in an hour.
And he was waiting for the moment. He was prepared.
He was prepared with his hatchet. He didn't need a gun. You know, he was old school. You know, guns are that's for weak men. Strong men have hatchets. You know, imagine that.
It's better for close range.
Exactly. For a McDonald's,
I want to see the light ooze out of your eyes.
Look, he knows the terrain of battle. He knows the terrain of battle. McDonald's, it's close quarter combat. hatchet is far more effective than a pistol, you know. So he knows, like, if you're in the Midwest, you need a pistol. It's like, it's a big car park out there outside midnight rodeo and the strip club. You got a lot of space, the gun works better. In an urban environment, we need close, you need your hatchet, your knife, your your batleth, for the Star Wars fans out there, be prepared. But yeah, it is very depressing to see all this stuff.
I want to add to the depression real quick, and I definitely want to get Chris's take on this. A few months ago, we did a story about where I lived in Wood Street in Oakland, and the people that came on the show were discussing the clearing of now the largest encampment in the city of Oakland. That's actually where I live across from. The citizens in the encampment were able to get an injunction on the order to remove, but sadly that was only temporary, and the eviction just started. Hundreds of people have been forced out of the area, displaced throughout the city. Some have found housing, and I can't speak to if it's temporary or permanent supportive housing. According to the article I read from KTVU News, the state has provided $4.7 million in grants to the city of Oakland to rehouse those living along Wood Street, according to Caltrans. But an attorney representing the homeless in an ongoing legal battle with the city of Oakland, Alameda County, and the state said adequate shelter was not offered to residents, forcing many to stick it out and stay in the encampment. Residents have just been scrambling to try to figure out what to do, attorney Bridget Nicoletti said. If you remember, she came on the show a few months ago with the Wood Street people. We've seen a lot of people moving further into Wood Street, which means the next phase is going to be even more difficult than this one was. The sprawling encampment is located underneath the MacArthur Maze in West Oakland, has experienced 195 fires between March 2020 and March 2022, and then a deadly fire occurred in April. In July, a large fire destroyed several motorhomes and damaged a portion of the I-880 freeway, resulting in highway lane closures and causing very large traffic tie-ups. Despite attempts to clear the encampment, it wasn't until a judge gave the go-ahead last month, allowing the evictions and the cleanup to occur. I was actually there when fires started, and they were massive, frightening, and constantly unexpected. I don't know if the average person has ever heard a car or an RV blow up. It does not sound like the movies. And when it blows up right next to you, it's definitely not cool. It's really sad to see these sweeps happen, especially because this is where I lived. These are my former neighbors, but wanted to get you guys' opinion on this real quick before we go into something a little lighter.
Boy. Now, there are homeless encampments in Chicago, but not concentrated like that. Mm-hmm. You know? And so I guess don't present the same kind of, like, spectacular safety hazards or something. And the police are kind of gentle on them here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thankfully. But because in the neighborhood, actually, like in the park, in the lakefront park near where I live.
Are you seeing an increase in Chicago of homeless people? Is it becoming visibly noticeable?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like, because it strikes me, and we've discussed this quite a bit, the liberal and the radical liberal approach to homelessness often fetishizes a particular technocratic solution, which may be a useful solution as part of a broader suite of policies. But as Jason always says, you know, for many homeless people, just giving them a shelter is a positive step, but is no way going to solve an issue, especially if you're dealing with people with drug issues, mental health issues. And also, we tend to view the homeless as a homogeneous group. There are probably millions of people who are working class people who are homeless, but they're not necessarily the same people you see on the street. They're the people who sleep in their cars, who are couch surfing. So we have like this, we have this huge problem. But it does seem, especially since COVID, that there is this enormous, likely, a far more visible, there's a far more visible homeless population. And what I find really interesting, and Chris, I don't know if you could speak to this, is Because in America, nobody believes the state can do anything, or that this is anything to do with the state. We don't even blame this on politicians. Like in the 1930s, they called the homeless encampments Hoovervilles, right? But we don't call these homeless encampments Bidenvilles, right? Because we just don't even, we can't even conceptualize.
It's been like, naturalized. I mean, really, I feel like there is a kind of new kind of homelessness of the last historical period, probably starting in the 70s, that is different, and it's been naturalized. I mean, it coincided with the kind of deterioration of the cities in the 70s and 80s, because certainly when I was growing up, New York had a lot of visible homeless people, like people sleeping on the streets, the way it's coming back now. And I think that for younger people, they haven't seen that before. So I saw that as a teenager, you know, going to going to school at Columbia University in my last years of high school. I saw a lot of that in Manhattan, in, you know, in kind of prime real estate parts of New York. And also when I moved to Chicago after college in the early 90s. But then it sort of went away and now it's coming back. And I have a feeling that things are going to get worse before they get better. So it's been naturalized. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot, I guess, there are a lot of different factors to it. But, you know, I think that, I mean, just a basic thing about like working poor people, right? Obviously, people either don't want to or can't live with their families the way they used to. Right. So maybe in the 1930s, you could still have a familial household absorb people, right, in a way that is more difficult now, I think. And so I think that there's just, things have changed. I mean,
I think the issue about family is as well, whereas in the 30s, intergenerational living was seen as normal. And but the, you know, the rise of Fordism, the formulation of the nuclear suburbanization has destroyed that. So now when people move back to their families, it's seen as a humiliation. How many boomer and Gen X jokes are based on making fun of millennials having to live in their parents' basements because of the economic disaster of the period that we're living in? So it's because that issue has become a kind of moralized issue. Whereas in the past, I mean, like, I have to say, like, in my personal opinion, you know, I think intergenerational living is a positive. It's more healthy. It's more positive. You know, when people accuse Marxists of being against the family, I think it's important to recognize, you know, Engels, I think it was, he didn't call for the abolition of the family. He called for the sublation or the Aufhebung of the family, which is like taking it to a superior level, because we live in a society where, for me and my partner, you know, with our kids, we're like isolated and alone. We're very fortunate to have the financial means to help with us, but without, you know, it's not a easy way of living. And for, you know, the model of parenthood and family is, you know, this bourgeois model of like you have to be simultaneously both
an independent nuclear family.
Independent, and it's an impossibility. So we live in this kind of era where like all these social structures are degenerating.
I mean, at the same time, I would just say that because it's become a norm for so long, that when people have to, out of economic need, move in with each other, it actually is authentically more stressful. And it does cause things like fights, domestic violence. It actually does cause those things in a way that, you know, 100 years ago wouldn't have. But now it actually does.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess that makes sense. We don't have the cultural competence, as they call it in academia, to actually deal with these situations because we've never had to deal with them before.
We're not raised. It's not our culture anymore. That's not our culture anymore. It isn't.
No, it's actually.
Children need their own bedrooms, right? Like, there are expectations of privacy that are just different. It's not our culture. It's not our psychology anymore. We're not prepared to deal with.
And I think that's why we're having so many problems right now, because, like, you know,
it goes into depression. I had to move back with my parents. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, that's not a bad thing. But let's lighten it up a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm going to say three evil words. Star Wars prequels.
Well, we've got a quote. We've got a quote, if you would like me to read it from Chris's article.
Yes,
please.
So, what more recent movies show is the lifeblood of cinematic history has been drained entirely out of filmmaking. For those with the eyes to see, namely everybody, Lucas's Star Wars prequel series, hence, might stand amongst the very last real authentic films in history. Not for the reasons of Lucas's own artistic genius, however considerable, but rather due to history and its apparent end in recent times. The sense of tragedy and comic ironies from history has been lost. This has affected all art forms, but perhaps cinema, as the late capitalist cultural phenomenon par excellence, most of all. So yeah, this is from an article which I actually requested.
Solicited,
I solicited this article from Chris because we've talked a little bit about sci-fi on the old Facebook chat, and Chris is a big Star Wars fan. You know, people may know Chris as from his educational endeavors, but also he is a keen science fiction fan, a keen connoisseur of movies. And you're an art historian by training, is that correct, Chris? So I asked him to make the case for the Star Wars prequels, because when taken in the whole context of Star Wars and the expanded universe, but also the movies, the mainline movies, of course the first three movies are the best, most entertaining movies. But also the last three movies are the most technically proficient with the greatest acting, but they are the worst movies. And the prequel movies, although I think they are like technically, on a technical level, I think they are like poorly written and badly executed. I think on a deeper spiritual level, they have a substance that is not non-existent in this new wave of movies that has come out.
And it's also not there in the original trilogy as much. It's only hinted at.
Yeah, it's hinted at in the original trilogy. But there really is a kind of spiritual essence to these, even though I think maybe somebody should have like told George Lucas,
they were overly ambitious.
Yeah, or maybe nobody could say like, George, it's a good idea, but let's get someone in to like rewrite that dialogue a little bit about sand. You know, maybe. maybe we should, you know, because you can have a good idea and a good vision for a story, but not be able to execute on that vision in the most entertaining way. And I think there is a vision to this story. So I figured Jason has a few questions he wanted to start with. So I'll throw it to Jason. Great. Since you wanted to hit this up.
Well, Star Wars, which is released on the year of my birth, 1977, and your article comes out on my birthday, August 19th.
Oh, wow.
I was like, this is the serendipitous.
Happy birthday gift.
Wasn't it? And so it brought me back to a conversation I was having with my daughter not too long ago when I was back up in the States. And it was, we were watching like the Clone Wars cartoon.
Oh, yeah.
And it was my daughter, my 4-year-old son. My daughter's 24, a 4-year-old son, and then her boyfriend is also 24. And I had asked her boyfriend what was his favorite Star Wars, and he goes, "Oh, the first one, the one with the kid racing and winning," is what he said.
Phantom Menace.
Yeah, the fan. I was like, "Yeah, that's what I was like, the Phantom Menace." He goes, "Yeah, that one." And I said, "Why?" And he goes, "Well, that was the first one I saw." And he goes, "And the kid I saw when I was a little kid, and then I saw a little kid, you know, win." So I was like, "Yeah, I'm all in for this." So what was it about the prequels that you wanted to revisit and write this piece?
All right, so obviously I wanted to get it at a political level, right? So I wanted to bring up the issues of Lucas's political parable, which at the time, you know, was very much interpreted in terms of the war on terror. You know, when Obi-Wan Kenobi says to Anakin Skywalker right before their final duel in Revenge of the Sith, only the Sith thinks in black and white.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because Anakin had said, if you're not with me, you're against me, which everybody took to be a repetition of George W. Bush's line, you know, on the war on terror, if you're not with us, you're against us. And, you know, I feel like, okay, yes, there's a point of contact there, but I actually thought that Lucas's political vision was less about current events in the early 2000s than it was about his own childhood background and his own mid-20th century experience and his experience as a young man in the 60s and 70s of the crisis and changes in American politics, like the Vietnam War and, you know, other things.
The original Star Wars is heavily based on the Vietnam
War. It is. I mean, it's an interesting thing, though, because on the one hand, the original Star Wars also has that quality to it, but it reads more as World War II.
Yes. Mm-hmm. With the iconography of World War II.
Right. And so, which again, it's kind of like, in some ways, the New Left generation did try to interpret their own history in terms of World War II. You know, like, the New Left called LBJ a fascist. They didn't only call Nixon a fascist, they called LBJ a fascist. Right? So, again, I kind of feel like that's the deeper history. And so the question is, what was George Lucas trying to say from his history to young people? Yes, like young children who are seeing Star Wars for the first time in the 2000s.
That's kind of interesting. That you talk about how it was received at the time. I mean, I've always, especially the prequel, I mean, the iconography of the original movies is definitely this World War II
iconography.
Stormtroopers, like, just the whole...
Starfighters fly like propeller planes.
Right, exactly. It's very much...
Star Destroyers as tanks.
Yeah, or rather the Pacific War battleship Navy movie. It's very much on that genre. And of course, Lucas, as you mentioned, he's brought up in a context where they're making these movies. And I think something to understand, I mean, I always interpreted also the prequel movies as being a salutary tale that is like a loosely veiled version of the rise of Nazism in Germany, which... I suppose I would interpret that way, being born and raised in Britain. It's really difficult to stress how central World War II is in the British national consciousness, even in a way that it's not central to the American national consciousness. So obviously, when I was growing, when I saw these movies, even as a teenager, it's like, oh yeah, this is like what we're learning about in school with the Nazis and things like that, and about how dangerous. And it strikes me that, you know, Lucas's generation, they had their contemporary Vietnam, which shaped their perceptions of things, but like the background is this heroic World War II struggle, which provides the visual metaphors that are used in the movie, provides some of the terminology, and provides a kind of structure to the world building. Would you say that's kind of fair? A fair assessment?
It is. So, you know, what I'd also say, though, is that, you know, the shift from the Weimar Republic to Nazi Germany is a fairly obscure thing that means a great deal probably to Germans, but not so much to Americans, and maybe not so much to, like, British, French, Italian people like today. Like, it's not like a really loaded reference. And so, again, the crisis of democracy, the idea of a democracy turning into a dictatorship, there are historical examples for that, but I don't think they're ready at hand for American viewers or more broadly international viewers, because obviously Star Wars is seen all over the world, right? So if it is like coming out of an American kind of director in an American cultural context, it still has to be kind of intelligible to young people in the early 2000s around the world, right? It's kind of a global film market at that point. And so I feel like it's not tied just to the Weimar Republic turning into Nazi Germany. It becomes a kind of a broader question of democracy. Now, again, with the war on terror, you know, was that a crisis for American democracy? It felt so at the time. It did. But I feel like it's been eclipsed by other things like the Great Recession and the emergence of Trump. And, you know, like now it's, and even the Sandinistas represent a kind of crisis of democracy in the sense that it's a challenge to the Democratic Party, right? And so there is this kind of, okay, what is the state of American democracy? So it resonates now differently than when it came out, and yet for the same generation. So I, you know, I very self-consciously wanted to say, okay, I know that the millennials were raised on Star Wars, and now they're coming of age, and, you know, in the Trump era, crisis of the American Republic, what's going to happen? And how does it work now, right? And that, again, Lucas's imagination, I'm not sure that for George Lucas, growing up in the United States, the story of the Weimar Republic turning Nazi is particularly salient. I don't think it really is. Hmm. I think much more it's a question of the 60s, the new left moment. It's much more a question of we're supposedly a free, you know, liberal democracy. In the Cold War, we represent freedom. But what about these things like the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War? And what the hell's going on here? You know, is this a democracy? What kind of democracy is this?
Right. So aesthetically, it's borrowing from the Second World War because that's the predominant film idiom of the time. But in terms of its themes related to democracy, you see it as a kind of parable for what's happening in the United States in the 60s and 70s, where you do have a constitutional parliamentary order, but increasingly that parliamentary order is seen either as being entirely bypassed by the military-industrial complex,
right,
or is just purely manipulated by hidden interests from behind the scenes.
Manufacturing consent, Noam Chomsky, for sure. And at the Rebels, like the original Star Wars movie, right? Mm-hmm. It's like these, you know, Aryan, gaunt, kind of imperial white people, mm-hmm. right? And then the Rebels, you know, they're kind of like men and women and overweight and kind of...
Granola, that kind of granola.
You know? Yeah. But, you know, like, a fat guy's flying an X-wing.
Like they're different species.
I mean, they get more into that, right? But originally, it's just, you know, they're humans. Like the Rebels are humans, the Imperials are humans, but the Rebels still seem like, you know, a kind of motley assortment, more diverse group of people than the Imperials.
Yeah,
like, I mean, do you see any women Imperials, first of all?
The aesthetic is also...
You don't see them in the movies, no. You see them in the cartoons and now the new movies.
The new movies, sure.
But no, you don't see them in the...
Right? So, like, there's kind of feminism. There's, like, a little bit of hippiedom. You know, like, in other words, the Imperials are all clean-shaven. The Rebels have facial hair. You know, like...
That's a good point.
It's right there in the 77 in the original Star Wars movie.
And their ships, are kind of a hodgepodge of ragtag force as well. So, you know, I mean, that's what makes it a powerful set of movies anyway, because the visual metaphors are so easily understandable.
Right.
You know, it's almost like you have Aristotelian ideal types of what an empire is and what rebels are, mm-hmm. purely devoid of ideology, just in terms of aesthetic. You know, like it's very... It's like from that opening scene where there's a big Star Destroyer chasing a little ship, you know, it just really sets up the story. You know what it's about.
Another thing I think is important about the prequels that I think we don't talk about is the fact that the Empire actually overthrows this Senate or this Republic. It's like a Republic of Monarchs.
Right.
You know, and... There is inequality in the outer rims of the galaxy, right? Like Jakku, you see in the new movies. There's slavery.
Yeah.
Han Solo comes from a slave planet. Anakin's parents, or Anakin himself, is a slave. Yeah. Tatooine is the nowhere land where all the ne'er-do-wells hang. It's kind of like the hood of the galaxy where the new Mandalorian show takes place. But they made it more of a Western than a than an inner city The Wire type show, which they could have done. but I think you brought up something interesting when I was reading your piece early this morning. Again, was the color contrast between the movies. And I think that was a huge thing. I went to the theater to watch all the redos. And then I went to go see, of course, the prequels. And what really turned me off was just it was so bright. And I didn't know it right away, but when I went and saw it a second time, because I was like, was it really as bad as I thought? And it was just so bright, and it was really long and wordy. But first and foremost, the colors and the imagery wasn't what I was used to seeing, because most of Star Wars, you know, it takes place in space and in bleak situations. Tatooine, Dagobah, for the most part, indoors, kind of a really bloody battle when you think about, you know, what's happening. So if you want, can you get into the whole color contrast as well? I thought that was really interesting.
Right. So, I mean, I'm trying to think of when he redid the movies and 96? Added CGI and kind of ran them through the theaters before The Phantom Menace came out. Mm-hmm. I feel like he did make them a little bit more colorful or something.
He did brighten them up, yes.
Yeah, and I don't know if he was getting us ready, because then Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones and the Revenge of the Sith are, like, super colorful. Like, very kind of saturated with color in a way that, you know, wouldn't have made sense in the original Star Wars movies, because the original Star Wars movies are a kind of bleak universe, you know, like where the Emperor and the Empire, they've been ruling for a while. You know, the dark side is, like, in control. And so, yeah, I mean, the way I discussed it in the article, I talk about, like, a kind of Art Deco kind of aesthetic of the Republic, which, again, like, in historical terms, would be, like, early 20th century. It would be the 20th century, like, really early, like, late 19th, early 20th century, like, before World War One and before World War Two. So after World War One, and especially after World War Two, architecture becomes, like, brutalist, and it becomes, like, you know, the sort of new international style, like the Mies van der Rohe world. And that is the world that George Lucas grew up in. That's the world that I grew up in as well. I mean, before postmodernist architecture starts to get gaudy again, maybe in the last 30 years. But, like, the visual world of, like, New York City in the 70s and 80s looks like the Empire. And the visual world of the Republic looks like, you know, if we had color photographs of, like, Art Deco buildings, like the first skyscrapers from the Gilded Age before World War One and World War Two, like before the kind of loss of innocence, right? Because this is, I kind of feel like Lucas and Spielberg, a lot of what they do, especially with these kind of children audience oriented films, is that, you know, people have talked about this, but, and they do a kind of loss of innocence kind of stuff. There is a kind of nostalgia kind of thing going on. And so it's kind of like, well, when was the innocence lost? When did it happen? Right. And it's just interesting because the visual style gives a lot of cues to the historical imagination going on there.
Yeah. It's such a, there's so much subtle symbology in these movies that later movies, I think, they're drawing on Star Wars, not the metaphors. They're drawing on a kind of secondary well. Jason and I often talk about this with,
like, left media. Like a superficial imitation of the style.
Exactly. We talk about this with left media, that, you know, you have left media, but then you have a whole ecosystem of left media, which all it does is comment on other left media and draw on other left media as an example. So it's not actually engaging with the original concrete subject matter.
Right.
So we see this kind of, I don't know what this.
Everything's
a meme. It's like, what's his name? The new Star Wars movies are, to use a Bourdieuian word, a simulacra of a Star Wars movie. They have all the things that you think a Star Wars movie needs, but there is a, it's almost like I don't know. It feels like a corporate committee
that
wrote this movie.
There's things that feel a little forced,
mm-hmm.
and then it's not developed. So, for example, Finn's character in the first Force Awakens movie leaves a lot of mystery, and apparently the actual actor, who I think is an extraordinarily good actor, he's some other movies he's in will kind of blow me away. He took the role, and they were like, "We have all this stuff planned for you." And I don't know if it was the backlash. I don't know if it was just a bunch of different directors and writers.
What was that backlash against Finn?
The original backlash was racist, right? Because we have to understand that there's a ton of racism in Star Wars fans. When George Lucas married that black woman, oh my God, I went to the Star Wars site.
Oh my God. Okay.
Oh my God. And she wasn't like, they were like, this gold digging ass. I was like, she's a.
By the way, I will hold it against Chicago. Like, I have a lifelong deep resentment of Chicago. Chicago ruined my life. Like, I moved here after college, and Chicago has ruined my life. And the one thing they could have repaid me with is if they put the fucking Lucas Museum in Chicago like they were supposed to. Mm. But instead, the NIMBYites, the yuppies, right? Like, they protested against having the Lucas Museum here, and so it's not here. Fuck.
Why would they do that?
Yeah.
Why don't they want a Lucas Museum?
Because they wanted to, like, preserve the lakefront or some shit. And it's like, the lakefront is toast anyway. Like, it was going to be near the McCormick Center, big, like, convention center. And so it wasn't going to really take any, like, nice parkland lakefront space. It was not. Right. But they made these bogus arguments. Right. Because they had to, it was the Democrats. They had to litigate. Right. They had to sort of pull out all the building codes and all the laws and say, oh, well, we can't put the Lucas Museum here because it's going to violate the ratio of parkland to, like, built structure.
Of course they did.
They could totally violate that with the Obama Library, by the way. About that with the Obama Library, because they're actually ruining a nice park. Jackson Park, near Hyde Park. They're ruining a really nice park for the fucking Obama Library.
I would take George Lucas over Obama any day of the week.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But
his wife's from Chicago.
Well, the interesting.
They got married here in Chicago. They got married near where I used to live down in Hyde Park, and that's why he wanted to put the museum in Chicago.
But of course, they came in and ruined it.
Yep.
But I mean, like,
fucking white liberals. Everything.
I mean, to get back to Jason's point, I think, you know, there were a lot of threads in those new movies that, I mean, for all their flaws, the old movies had an arc and a vision, and they were going somewhere. They had this holistic story which took us from the kind of dying days of the Republic to the emergence of a Bonapartist regime and the liquidation of the previous elite groups that had left the society in kind of gridlock and failed. And there was a vision to that. There was this story arc that took place, which was the downfall of Anakin Skywalker. There was whole Obi-Wan Kenobi. Again, all of these storylines could have been executed on much more effectively. It was poorly written. There was, like, the dialogue was bad. It was good enough for kids, but...
Can I give you a hypothesis about this?
Yeah.
Because there's such a contrast, right? So if you look at the story, if you look at the dialogue between Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan Kenobi...
Right.
And their story in the first movie as opposed to the Anakin story.
Right.
And then in the second movie, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi chasing down Jango Fett.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then, you know, Count Dooku. As opposed to the Anakin story, the Anakin Padme story.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the third movie, Obi-Wan Kenobi going after General Grievous and, you know, leading the clone troops in the Battle of Utapau, and, you know, and also the Yoda leading the troops to defend the Wookiees, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there are no false notes there, right? The false notes are only Anakin and Padme. And they're Anakin. And so it's not like George Lucas doesn't know how to write dialogue. It's not, right? I think that he was doing something specifically with those characters and with their romance. Like, I think it's deliberately awkward, right? Through all three movies. I think it's really like, you know, because you know, Anakin falls in love with Padme as soon as he sees her, even though she's older and he's a young kid. He's like, are you an angel?
Are you an angel?
Yeah. And like, people hate this, but it's very deliberate. It's super deliberate. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure.
Because the other dialogue doesn't have that problem, right? It's only really the Anakin and Padme stuff.
Well, you know, some people are just bad at doing romance. I mean, do you know the novelist Harry Turtledove? Do you know who Harry Turtledove is? Uh-huh. So he writes these alternative history fictions, which the best one is where lizard aliens land in World War II. And, like, the books are quite fun, but he, like, insists on putting sex scenes in them, which just make your stomach turn. It's like, there's nothing worse
than
that.
I mean, it might be that George Lucas can't do romance. No, that might be a point. But I also feel like regardless of his, like, skill or lack thereof and, you know, the atrociousness, the effect of it,
mm-hmm.
right? The effect of it is that I think that it's a mistake to think that the main character is Anakin in some straightforward way, right?
Yeah, I totally agree with you in that.
It's
I
not
think...
like Luke Skywalker. In the first trilogy, Anakin is a different kind of character, and we're supposed to be alienated from him to a certain extent. We are.
That would be what I would say is, like, you can understand the intention, I guess.
Yeah.
But I feel like the film would have been the films would have been much better, for example, if they'd focused had Anakin as a kind of outsider and focused more on Obi-Wan as the core character, because it kind of felt that, I mean, if you want to go to the dark side of what I'd say, like, my idea would be, like, totally, like, Padme is hooking up with Obi-Wan, but then, like, Anakin uses his dark side powers to seduce and impregnate Padme at the end, so there's a wrongness of their love.
I think you're talking about me, Gene. I think I am Anakin.
Oh, no. That's terrible. It's not like love is the dark side, although it is. Like, you know, so Gene...
Love is the dark side.
You used an image for my article in Sublation Magazine that I thought was well chosen, because it's when Anakin is meeting with Yoda, and he's basically asking Yoda... And Yoda's saying, you have to let go of Padme. And at that moment, he's lost Anakin. Right?
Right.
Let go of everything that you fear to lose. And Anakin is like, that I cannot do. And if it means not being a Jedi, so be it. Right? Like, that was it. Right? And you know, obviously the image that you chose... You know, the sun coming through
with
the slats. Yeah, like, and so there is something, we're supposed to feel like there's something wrong with this romance. You know?
What is that?
Yeah, and it's like a kind of, you know, because you don't really get the romance characterized hardly at all, right?
No, it's like, very, it's like, it feels... That, like, the whole falling in love just feels like, what is it? You have them, like, talking on a balcony, rolling around in a field, and it doesn't feel earned.
And you're kind of wondering, like, how old is she supposed to be, right? You're like, is she, like, how old was she when they met? Like, an old-looking 12? Is he supposed
She's
to be
like 15, and he's supposed to be, like, 8 or 9.
I think he's supposed to be 6.
Oh, he's 6? Okay, so then she's, like, 10 years older, then. Or 9 or 10 years older, yeah. Which is, you know, makes sense. And then I guess that means in Revenge of the Sith, she's like in her early 30s and he's in his early 20s or something.
Yeah. It's, I don't know, the relationship, I feel
she's a cradle robber. She's a cradle robber.
Yeah.
I will say this, and though this is kind of off the topic of the prequels, I didn't like the portrayal of Princess Leia in the Obi-Wan series. that
first. Oh, the little girl. Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. It got better. I didn't like it at first.
Yes.
I really didn't like the Obi-Wan series at first. But then it got much better. And then when it's revealed that the Inquisitor, the woman, the black woman,
was a youngling.
Like a youngling, yeah, who survived the purge. And I just thought, okay, now it's all justified.
Yeah.
It was just kind of annoying. I was just like, who is this crazy bitch and who cares?
Jason knows this about me because I was like, man, I don't like that Inquisitor. He's like, why don't you like that lady? She's like pretty good. I was like, no, I think she sucks. But that's
gratuitously sadistic, and it just seemed like, why and who cares? Do you know? Yeah. Like, it's like, nah. You know?
But again, with a lot of this, I mean, what we're getting with all this Star Wars, like we've talked about like the themes in the original Star Wars sequel, and we can debate till the cows come home about like the technical merits of how it was executed, but you don't see any of this in you see this in, I think, in Mandalorian perhaps, in some of the things which Disney perhaps allows a little bit allows a little bit to be, you know, a little bit of creative control for an artist to implement their vision. So, like, the Clone Wars got really good because the people writing it were able to implement, like, a real like a vision they had. And maybe you like that vision, maybe you don't like that vision, but it's a vision. But I feel a lot of the a lot of what Hollywood does is when they find something successful, they end up turning it into a prestige or a simulacra of itself. So.
It's like a working or winning formula, and we're just going to milk it dry.
This is what happened with Game of Thrones. We were discussing this on Gaming Materialists. You know, it was good because it was a story where you had these twists, but also there was a deeper thing about it, that it was a story about people who were forced to do things about because they were in particular social and political conditions, and they couldn't just go with what they wanted to do. But that was kind of thrown out in the final seasons, and it became a psychodrama, but except where people could get killed, right? Yeah. So the twists had power in Game of Thrones because they'd really been earned, but then the twists become, it's the J.J. Abrams school of direction, the black box, where he goes on, where he goes, oh, you have to have a mystery and a mystery. But eventually, when you realize there's no actual fucking mystery there in the end, you're like, you feel cheated. So it's kind of like eating a load of popcorn and enjoying it at the time, and then feeling sick afterwards and regretting eating all that popcorn. And this was what the problem was with the new Star Wars movies. Yeah. Nobody was given, there was some potential with it, of course. There was so much money behind it. But because it felt like it was literally a series by committee where they switched out directors.
I mean, can I just say, I hate to be like generational, but I'm going to be generational.
Ugh.
And it's my generation. It's J.J. Abrams, right?
Right.
It's like, I think we just don't have an idea. We don't have a vision. We have nothing. There's nothing that we want to say or do, really. You know, because I feel this way about Christopher Nolan, too. You know, I kind of feel like, is he saying something? Is he not? I kind of feel like, yeah, you know, like, you know, the Batman movies, Interstellar, and what's the one with the time paradox?
Oh, the stupid one, Inception.
Inception. I kind of feel like there's half an idea, right?
Right.
But it's kind of like, you know, so it's sort of tantalizingly close to an idea, but I kind of feel like, but there isn't an idea. And it's like, fuck, our generation doesn't have an idea.
They have like a gimmick. Like so many of these movements can come up with a gimmick, but they lack the imagination to execute upon that gimmick, right? It becomes simply, it becomes all aesthetics, all style, and no substance. This was like, this was the problem with the J.J. Abrams Star Wars, Star Trek movies were the same. You know, they were kind of like, and entertaining, I guess, but like very soon after you watched them, you're like, and this was like not really a great movie. It was like fun in the moment, but it's not really rewatchable.
So here's the difference between the prequels and the sequels,
mm-hmm.
and also the prequels and the original trilogy. What they have in common is that you do walk away with something. You do.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of feel like the problem is that the prequels challenged people. It's almost like you walked away with too much, where it was like, huh? Right? Whereas with the sequels, you walk away with nothing.
Yeah.
Like you leave the theater like thinking about it, right? You walk out of the prequels still thinking about it, but you're not sure what you're supposed to think about it. And I actually think that's really the point. You know, you're not sure how you're supposed to feel about these characters. And especially, like, again, Anakin and Padme, because it's like, you know, the star-crossed lovers, tragic romance or something. You're not sure how you're supposed to feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
And it's kind of like, it makes you feel a little bit like foreboding or something, but you are affected by it. Whereas I feel like the new movies, they just run you over and then you're just done.
And they don't make sense on their own terms. Like, everything seems to be what it needs to be, but it isn't. It's like, for example, Kylo Ren, like, could have been an interesting character. Somebody who was like, whose grandmother was a slave. His grandfather was like the king of the fascists, and he's like coping with that legacy and what that means. Or you could have someone like Finn, who was a stormtrooper, and what it means. But like, Finn just stops being a stormtrooper, and then he's just like a normal dude. He's just like a normal. So there was no, you know. And they even the most interesting thing about the second movie, where it turned out that the what was the lady called, I forget her name.
Which
The main lady in the new movies.
Right.
It's like, oh, you're nobody. You don't have a legacy. You know, you're not. You like, that would have been a cool point to make, but then they completely reverse it and turn it in the third movie to make it the Chosen One story. And it just, none of it makes sense. Like, why are there rebels? Why are there rebels? Because the Republic's in power. Like, what's, you know, none of it makes sense. I mean, with the book series, especially the Timothy Zahn books.
Oh yeah, the Thrawn
books.
They're really good.
Were really good. It was about an imperial remnant and a kind of Alexander the Great type. A story of, you know, a strong military commander coming in and taking advantage of the chaos of a new regime in the Republic. But this story that they came up with the Poland.
In the expanded universe, they had like Luke's struggle to train a new generation of Jedi, and like some of them going bad, and you know, the dark side was kind of recessed. Like, it's like the Kylo Ren story. So they actually did take some things from the expanded universe.
Right.
But then they like botched it.
Right.
You know? And because, you know, like all of that could have been much more interesting. Absolutely. Like the Kylo Ren character could have been much more interesting.
Rey could have been much more interesting.
Rey could have been more interesting. You know, Luke's return could have been more interesting. You know, even Leia's return could have been more interesting. I don't know. It's just, yeah. So, but again, I kind of feel like, so the art of filmmaking, like the quotation that you started out with, right?
Mm-hmm.
I kind of feel like the art of filmmaking is being lost, and it has to do with the way we experience history. And so, right. You know, it's kind of like, do we experience the accumulation of history, or is history kind of flattened? Mm-hmm. So that there's just a sort of infinite amount of like historical references that one can draw upon more or less equally. But there isn't a sense of accumulation. There isn't a sense of like direction or coming to a crisis.
Yeah. So it's all aesthetics, no substance, no context for anything that is happening. So you have all these. You have like a Frankenstein of historical images and references, but none of the context that give it any type of meaning.
Which, by the way, I think that people experienced the original Star Wars that way. Like, I think that film critics in the 70s and in the 80s, they were like, oh, what is this mishmash? Right. And this is why it was like postmodernist.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, well, wait, okay, so you thought that that was happening, that Lucas was and Spielberg were just doing a kind of a mishmash.
Mm-hmm.
But wait until what Gen X and the millennials are going to do, right? Oh, you know, it's like if you thought that that was the liquidation of history, wait, it's going to be totally liquidated now.
Yeah, because, I mean, despite the kind of Frankenstein of both historical references and also science fiction references, it is ultimately a liberal set of movies, right?
Yep.
Both the
Social vision, it's got a political sense, it's got a historical sense.
It's almost a kind of synthesis of Asimov's optimism and Herbert's pessimism, mm-hmm. into like a kind of liberalism that understands the flawed nature of bourgeois democracy, understands, especially in the prequel films, understands the problems that even a kind of well-meaning technocratic elite can...
The Jedi,
who are the ultimate sort of technocrat, that even though they're well-meaning, they can become detached from reality and lose sight of what is important. Mm-hmm. And so that vision, although liberal, is a vision which I don't think new movies have. New movies, perhaps might even be thought of as a degeneration of liberalism, in which the substance of liberalism is entirely reduced to the notion of having a diverse caste, having proper representation, and no substance to what that means, no interrogation of what that means.
So here, check it out. So I'll just make the Star Trek reference because it's kind of obligatory when you're talking about liberalism.
Of course.
Of course, I love Star Trek as much as I love Star Wars, but the liberalism of the Next Generation and even the liberalism of the original series kind of annoyed me, you know, because it just seemed too pat, you know. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the new Star Trek series and the sort of like PC woke liberalism of the new Star Trek series, it's on another level. Like, in other words, like, you know, definitely there were cringe moments in The Next Generation where it's like, oh, they're talking about homophobia, or they're talking about racism, or they're talking about sexism, right? There was a little bit of a cringe, you know, because me and my friends were watching it as it was broadcast, mm-hmm. and we're like, oh, this is just too, like, messagey, yeah. you know? But now it's on a whole other level, you know? Like, the new Picard series, and of course Star Trek Discovery, but even the new Picard series... And again, it's kind of like, okay, they're ticking these boxes, they're making these gestures, but the world that they're supposed to be in doesn't seem at all real or substantial. Like, it's not like, it's not taking you to another place and dealing with these things allegorically the way it was in The Next Generation or in Deep Space Nine or even in Voyager. It's just like our world. Except like special effects.
I have a term for it, Chris. I want to make this term popular. It's called HR liberalism. It's like basically it's basically that the HR department have got their hands on things. Now let's pass this a little bit, right? The issue is not the diversity.
No.
There is a theme of reactionary science fiction and Star Wars fans who do have like very peculiar racist and sexist hang-ups about diversity in their science fiction. That is an undeniable reality of the community. That is also, you know, it's also something that, you know, like makes people a lot of money on YouTube.
Could we do a like a maybe a more difficult dive into that?
Yeah.
Was there a racist backlash against Lando Calrissian? No,
not that I remember, but I don't recall because I wasn't old enough, but I've found that there were pieces that were small that actually complained that there were no black people in the galaxy.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and then Lando Calrissian comes in and, you know, but there wasn't a racist backlash, right? And then it's like, okay, is that because Lando Calrissian is the kind of like stereotypical black character and therefore acceptable? Because I don't think that's true either.
I mean, he's kind of, I mean, Jason and I have discussed this. He's kind of doing a space blaxploitation.
A little space pimpy. Yeah, he's a little space pimpy.
Not an Empire Strikes Back.
He's a little space pimpy in Empire Strikes Back. Well, he's the fastest hunk and dunk in the galaxy.
But it's not like, what's his name? Glover. It's not like what he did in the Solo movie, because that was absurd, where it's like, yes, I have a big dick and whatever, right? Like, but, you know, and it's just like, come on, man. Like, really? Let's see. Right?
I want to touch on, like, I agree. I would certainly say, like, I think deliberately as well, some of the movie studios and things like that focus on the purely reactionary aspect of criticism to these movies, that the people getting angry about.
I was just watching a YouTube video this morning that talked about fan baiting.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. The idea that that the fan base is deliberately provoked so as to distract from the poor quality of the movies.
Exactly. I think it's like you have like a small minority of people who are just like racist or sexist and they can't handle it. But then you have a whole other criticism that gets people who are criticizing the movie are dismissed, or just criticizing the series are dismissed, because they're like, oh, you just don't like it because there's
hypothesis, though. So my hypothesis is, when I look at like a Lando Calrissian character, or even when I look at the Gungans in The Phantom Menace, like Jar Jar Binks or Boss Nass, right, who are supposed to be some kind of whatever patois.
Jamaicans, they say. I never saw that.
And I kind of feel like, okay, so it's like, is like Billy Dee Williams, is it blaxploitation? I guess it sort of sounds like a little bit like an echo of something. But I kind of feel like, you know, if you look at the movies now and you look at the TV shows now and the way they're deploying race, I kind of feel like, fuck, people are more racist now than they were in the 80s, which is really saying something, because the 80s were fucking bad. Right. I mean, but I feel like maybe people are more racist now. Like, young people are more racist now than we young people were in the 80s.
I would actually racist. I would maybe complicate that. I think there is an issue with, I don't think it's just about racism. I think it's also, it's about,
and the PCism is like a kind of crazy racism too. Because it's
people are trying to cope with something. And people are having trouble with coping with it. You know, there was a period of like, I guess like.
I think not even the zeros were not like that. Like, I feel like it's very recent. You know, I kind of feel like, you know, we were watching The Rings of Power, me and my partner, and he's Malaysian, and Jason met him, Fazel, and he has a funny reaction to like interracial romance on screen.
Oh yeah.
And also he has like a kind of American gay-ism to him, meaning like black-isms, right? And so as soon as the black dwarf wife showed up in The Rings of Power, like, oh no, you didn't, right? Like, we're sitting there in the crowd, and he's like, oh no, you didn't. I'm like, I'm like living this crazy life where it's like my partner next to me is doing this like gay blackism that also is a little bit racist, and I'm seeing like the PC like gratuitous racial diversity racism on the screen, and I'm like, what fucking world am I living in?
Well, I think the issue is, you know, in trying to solve some of these racial problems, the liberal response has, even if well-meaning, has been counterproductive.
I don't think it's well-meaning. I actually don't think it's well-meaning. Because remember who's all doing, who's making the decisions. Remember who all the people are.
I'm not saying everybody's well, but I think there's a lot of people just regular.
I mean, probably a lot of well-meaning people, but I feel like there is a sort of a nasty edge that there's something going on, you know, where it's kind of like, because there's like a strident mission. Do you know, because it's kind of like, you know, like, I don't know, like Star Trek Deep Space Nine, like Avery Brooks, Captain Sisko. I don't think anybody thought, oh, they're making a black captain in order to like insist we have to have a black captain. It wasn't like that, right? And I don't think anybody was like, oh, this is just like liberal orthodoxy being imposed, like forcing the audience to accept a black captain. Like, not at all. Whereas now, the reason that it feels forced is that it is forced. You know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to say is...
Or Captain Janeway, it didn't feel like, okay, now it's time to have a woman captain, and we're going to force it on the audience. It was like, she's a woman captain. You know, it's like, okay, let's see how this goes. I don't know. Now it just feels like everything is to make a point. And I feel like that's like fucking racism and sexism, actually. That just is. And I don't know how well-meaning
well,
it is.
Well, you were talking about that with that Supergirl show, Gene, and the same people that wrote that Supergirl show wrote that really horrible football thing where they were kind of stuck in the 90s with the way they were kind of viewing athletics and the fish out of water story and just forcing every single type of new gender and racial paradigm that didn't really feel natural.
Well, I do.
Gay person, I hated the gay people on Star Trek Discovery because I was like, you know, why can't we just have gay characters? Why does it have to be like daring the audience to be homophobic? Like it felt like everything was like, you know, it was like, oh, are you a homophobe? Do you need
something? I thought that was the best part, that the fact that for the only white men in leading roles in Starfleet in the future are gay men. That's like the nightmare for the
Everybody else has a real life. The gays go to Starfleet because, you know,
I actually thought they were probably the most interesting characters. Like their relationship I thought was portrayed like
a normal. It was a normal
relationship. It was like there was nothing like weird about it. They were just
two dudes
in a normal
relationship. The way they introduced it, mm-hmm. it as like, I don't know, I felt it like it's not just matter of fact. It felt like now we're going to tell you this character is gay. Now we're going to show you and right? And it didn't just flow, do you know? And I felt like why are they making this so cringe? Because it doesn't have to be.
Well, wait till you see Black Superman is coming out.
Written by Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yeah, Obama Superman.
It is.
We're not even trying to be funny. Like, that's a real thing.
But if they did a comic book already, or what'd they do? Yeah. And then they're going to make a movie now? Well, Ta-Nehisi Coates. So the problem is not Black Superman. The problem is Ta-Nehisi Coates. That's the problem. Right?
I didn't mind his Captain America thing that he did with this while he was frozen. Either he did it or another writer. I swear it was him. But the whole story about the black Captain Americas that got the super soldier serum and it's a play on the Tuskegee experiment. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Okay, yeah.
But Black Obama Superman is just like he's the 44th president.
Yeah, I mean, like, the pure distillation of HR liberalism television is the show Bridgerton. I don't know if you know what Bridgerton is.
I have not seen that, no.
So Bridgerton is literally...
Is that a crime drama in Britain?
No. Bridgerton is a costume drama, right?
Oh.
It's like a Pride and Prejudice or whatever.
Is it set? When is it set? In what period?
It's in the Regency period, I think. It's like early 19th century, right? But it's in an alternative timeline where everybody is super diverse. And it's not simply that they do the thing in like they do in Hamilton where they just cast people of color for white people. It's like commented on as well. They say like, it's not simply just a diverse casting of a historical thing. But it really, in my opinion, and I think people should take a look at least an episode, it really encapsulates the notion of diversity that HR liberalism puts forward, which is where you have the a Regency elite, which is an imperialist, exploitative, brutal elite that barbarizes both the population of Britain and of India and of the Americas, that causes so much human suffering around the world. But it's all okay because we've cast a bunch of diverse people and they have like a black queenie and things like that.
No, and I'm curious now. Uh-huh.
It's a pure distillation of that ideology. So, you know, Pascal was sharing us this thing for a new TV show, Jason? Did you see that thing that he showed?
Like a treatment.
It was a
a trailer.
It was a black guidance school counselor who in her 40s changes career to become an FBI agent, and she's all like, no, you didn't. I'm in the FBI now. You know, like, really, like, it's like, oh my God, this is kind of, it was like very
sassy FBI. What do you get when you take
very sassy
guidance counselor and make her part of the FBI?
No, I think an inner city guidance counselor probably has a lot more skills than an FBI agent. Like, that would be like a step down.
Yeah, like, it wouldn't join the FBI, like, unless it had been.
You know what I mean? Wouldn't join the FBI. Yeah, just wouldn't. Yeah, it kind of wouldn't occur. No, I was gonna say about like the Hamilton reference, right? So like Hamilton, it's like cool. The founding fathers are people of color. All right, but then it was like taken up. It's like in the Obama presidency. It's like we have to perform it at the White House as like a thing.
Cringy.
And I kind of feel like, wait, it's cool. But then you're like beating us over the head with it. And I feel like that's when it sort of shifted, where it's like, you know, it can't just be, oh, what if you cast the founding fathers as black? How would you treat the characters in their drama? Right? It had to be, oh, well, look, the founding fathers are people of color, but they weren't. And like, oh, we're making the statement. And it's like, holy shit. People, you know, in other words, to my mind, I saw that again as evidence that people are getting more racist.
Well, I thought Hamilton was like,
I mean, Hamilton is bad.
It's offensively bad. I mean,
it's
like,
bad.
I'm
it's
not
historically one, bad. It's just bad. Yeah.
I'm not one of these people who's out there going like the American Revolution was a counter revolution and all the founding.
Well, all that is just horrible reactionary shit.
But you know, I think we have to take the rough with the smooth off the American Revolution. You know, like. You take the reality, and to to kind of paper over that, yes, this may have been a bourgeois revolution, it may have been progressive, but it was also, like many revolutions, had a very dark side and was maintained a system of forced labor across the country, like obfuscating that behind a kind of liberal color washing of it is I make the comparison. It's like having a play about the Iranian Revolution where Khomeini is played by a Baluchi lesbian, and it's like, ah, isn't that cool? Look at our revolution. I think no.
Yeah.
I think it's problematic because people should try and learn history, but learn both sides of the history, and learn like different. Like truths about history that and not just try and put it into this narrative that all, which is what all movies are going towards now, the Jason calls it the Avengerification of morality, where it's just like you have superheroes.
Oh my God.
Like and everything is just people. It's even in role play games now, like your role play game character in Dungeons and Dragons starts off as level one but has tons of powers and can totally go Avengers on people. Whereas in the old Dungeons and Dragons, you would get like murdered by a giant rat in a dungeon, like in the first couple of minutes. So you have this kind of desire, both liberals and conservatives, to paint this black and white history, to have movies where there's no moral ambiguity or there's no content. It's right. All aesthetic and no content. So, you know, that's the kind of tragedy that I think the new Star Wars films have got to, and where the prequels, for all their flaws.
So let me bring it back around to the prequels and really the point of my article, because I think the article, I didn't want to just say, oh, movies are for shit now. You know, like, I didn't want to say that. Because that's, like, a little bit pointless to say. It might be true, but it might also be a little bit pointless. That my point there was Lucas grew up in a world of moral ambiguity in the realm of society and politics. Who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? And that this can shift. And with the prequels, he went into that domain. And I think people rejected it at that level. I think that they really rejected that. They weren't, interested in that. They wanted like heroes and villains. They wanted it to be like clear. And it's like, wait, you know what you're getting into here. It's Anakin Skywalker who becomes Darth Vader, right? And yet, I do think that what people reacted to was that it wasn't good guys and bad guys the way it was in the original trilogy. And, you know, and I think the sequel trilogy also goes back to that, right? In other words, they try to do this kind of redemption of Kylo Ren the way there was a redemption of Darth Vader in the original trilogy, but they botch it. You know, it doesn't feel quite as real as it was in the original trilogy. But the prequels are all about this kind of ambiguous universe. And the fact that it is political, you know, that it's explicitly about that and that people rejected that. They were like, oh, you know, we want an action movie. We don't want
taxes and trade agreements.
Right. And, you know, I mean, I have a lot of Star Wars toys. I do. Mm-hmm. And especially coming out of the prequels, because I was really into the prequels as an adult person. And I had like young cousins and, you know, a niece and nephew. And, you know, so I had like, you know, a way of interfacing with this stuff. So one toy that was released was the Senate.
I didn't know they released the Senate.
There's like a little
like a
Senate.
Play set?
Yeah. Like a play set. Cool. And it has Palpatine's apartment behind the Senate chamber. Mm-hmm. And it's like, really, and it says like relive the exciting
the excitement of the Senate.
Yes. And I'm like, this is
that's
fucking awesome.
This is Chris Catrone's favorite toy is his model Senate set.
No, it is, and it's become a rarity now, of course, because I'm sure it didn't sell very much, so it probably wasn't like made in great numbers, but it's like a prized possession of mine for sure. Because I feel like this just captures something. Like, what was George Lucas thinking? Do you know?
The Senate playset. That's what he was thinking.
And this is before the big battle between Palpatine and Yoda in the third movie. This is just coming out of the first movie. It's like,
wow. I mean, E.T. is in the first Senate. E.T. is in the Senate? Remember that?
Yeah, E.T. was in the Senate. Yeah, there E.T.'s we go.
In the Senate.
Oh, he dropped him in like a little...
Yeah, like a little Easter egg of E.T. in the Senate.
The Senate's like relive the debate over the 2% increase in the marginal tax rate.
No, but it's about Valorum and Palpatine and Queen Amidala, and it's cool. It's cool.
There we go.
It's cool.
Well, I guess we are heading up on our time limit for today.
Another word that comes out that gets Palpatine elected? Corruption.
Corruption, yes. The golden word.
With Chancellor Valorum, that's how.
And bureaucratic rule, right? Like, you think that Valorum has the power, but look, it's the bureaucracy, and I promise to get the bureaucracy under control. Little did we know that Trump would be like, I'm going to get the deep state under control. Right?
That?
Why not Palpatine, Chris?
This is like the moment to have the soundboard.
Why not Palpatine? Yeah.
That's what's going to happen. You're going to have, what do you call them? The Pat socks are going to have...
Palpatine is awesome? Can I say...
Of course.
Of course you can.
He plays it so well. Like, it's
he's been in every movie. Awesome. Him and Anthony Daniels are the only ones, I think.
Yeah, and he... you know, the fight with Samuel Jackson, Mace Windu, is great.
Drain the swamp, Jar Jar Binks song.
Change us.
Oh no.
Jar Jar Binks is AOC.
For real. No, I mean, there's a lot of minstrelsy going on. In the world that we're living in today, people are going to look back in the future, hopefully. Like, a socialist future is going to look back at this time, and they're going to be like, they brought back the fucking minstrel show.
Damn.
You've seen Bamboozled, Spike Lee?
Yes.
It's a great movie.
I haven't seen it in a long time.
It's a great movie. I mean, it's a most Brechtian movie, right? Like, Spike Lee can do stuff. I feel like, you know, often he doesn't, but he can. And Bamboozled was interesting.
that's one of his few quote unquote message movies that I think hits really good because he's hitting on his world, which is Hollywood. Yes. Much like Mo Better Blues, I think hits pretty good because it's a story of people that he knows, bougie jazz playing Negroes. When he tries to do the inner city stuff, for me, doesn't hit.
Tricky, yeah.
Doesn't
hit. Too ham-fisted, yeah.
But the other stuff that is in his wheelhouse, like, there's a reason why people like She's Gotta Have It.
Oh, yeah.
Right? There's a reason why he is a big-time filmmaker. It's not just because there's a quote in the show.
But I do think that people are going to look back with shame at our time. And not in the way that people think. People are not going to look back in shame at, like, oh, how could Trump have been elected? They're going to look at the Democratic Party shit, and they're going to be like, what the fuck, you know? They're going to look at this madness, the kente cloth stuff, you know?
Yeah, the kente cloth was real.
I think it'll be a little bit of both.
Yeah, I mean, sure. But I also feel like, you know, like, again, people think Trump's controversial. They think the Democrats are normal. I think in the future, it's going to be like, how did people ever think that was normal?
Well, Chris, my thesis has always been that, or not always, has been since the Trump era, that Obama was actually the real prototype of Trump because he ran an entirely aesthetic campaign.
Yep.
He had the opportunity, if he'd had the political will, to probably reshape politics and reshape a political coalition. But he was he ended up just giving us regular Bill Clinton Democratic Party politics, but with hope and change. Mm-hmm. And Trump,
he did
the same trick, except with Republicans. Yep. He ended up doing the same old Republican bullshit, except just crueler, ruder, and and a little less competent because he pissed off all the competent people.
No, both Bernie and Trump were the anti-Obamas, but in ways that people don't understand what that means. Mm-hmm. Right? In other words, they were both promising to, like, do what Obama was supposed to do. They were both... No, because it was like Obama was supposed to reform things, and both Bernie and Trump promised to reform things.
Right.
And of course, Trump was not able to, and, you know, was only half interested, or he was interested in reforming like a few things, but everything else, and then he didn't even really get to do that. Bernie, of course, would never have been allowed to be the nominee, let alone president, because if you think the establishment is anti-Trump, the establishment would have been much more anti-Bernie.
And he would have been screwed by his own side.
Trump was too.
But Trump was screwed because Trump just picked the stupidest fights, right? He
became divisive in a point where, like, it was seriously becoming a problem in the even regular job space, right?
And the reason he couldn't create his own kind of new political coalition was simply because the dude was lazy. He was like incompetent. I mean, Obama had a skill to him about the way that he operated. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, these guys both were charisma presidents and they ended up trying to make money post-presidency. Obama's doing all this kind of celebrity stuff and people get worried about,
you heard the Glenn Greenwald thesis, right? So the Glenn Greenwald thesis is that after JFK, or maybe starting as early as like Eisenhower, that basically the president is just supposed to be a spokesmodel for the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And that the problem with Trump is that he thought that he was supposed to be more than just the spokesmodel of the bureaucracy. And you could also say that Obama, though personally competent, he also kind of understood the role better. Mm-hmm. In other words, he understood, although I'll never forget Samantha Power, you know, the foreign expert. You know, she said that they wanted to make changes and they learned very quickly the wisdom of maintaining U.S. policy. And she said the problem is that Trump is incapable of learning that lesson.
Right.
And I was like, that is not a lesson that anyone should learn or accept. Do you know?
Yeah.
Like, that is like the pits, right? And so anyway, yeah. But we're still in the midst of it. 2024 is coming. Oh,
and it's not going to be awful. It's going to be awful.
We're going to have 12 years of Trump instead of 8.
Oh, well, on that cheery note, thank you guys for hanging out. Chris, definitely thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Something near and dear to my heart. You have to come back on the Pop Life show at some point to talk toys. As I used to have before I lost everything, tons and tons of Star Wars stuff. Still, the holy grail for me is the original Death Star playset that I one day hope to get. Oh, even though it's kind of lame, I always loved it.
But
thank you very much. Thank you guys for watching, and we will see you guys Tuesday. Who's our guest Tuesday, Gene?
We have Ryan, but he actually just emailed me, so we have to talk about this after the show.
Oh, well, I guess we're going to have an after show conversation. Yeah. Thank you guys, and we are